Hi, this is Charles Wren at democraticfundamentalism.org with the news in review. It's Monday, December 30th, 2002, and it's midnight on the West Coast. I wanted to recap the recent events surrounding the resignation of Trent Lott as the Republican Senate Majority Leader, as well as make a few relevant points about the record of the Republican Party in regard to equal opportunity and integration of all races in our American democracy. I want to stress democracy. I feel it's important to recap them to underscore the truth about the record, as well as to assist in pointing out that Bill Frist's record is not actually any different than Lott's or the other six people who are contending for a position of Republican Senate Majority Leader. What you've seen in Senator Lott's resignation is actually giving the Bush administration and the Republican Party an opportunity to publicly say the problem has been addressed by Lott's resignation, to put on a good face. Meanwhile, nothing has really changed in the Republican policies or leadership. It's unlikely that policies will change, although it is likely you'll see token legislation being proposed to further the deception. I have to say, like James Carville, that I'm willing to accept Lott's apologies on a personal level, but I believe someone with his views and record should not be in a leadership role in democracy. He clearly shows what his position is on racial issues. I'm not at all convinced that his apologies are in earnest, given the consistency of his remarks over the years. Even worse, Lott and Tom DeLay have made remarks on several occasions that African Americans are treated better here in the United States than anywhere else in the world, and they should just be glad they live here. Those words are nearly exact quotes made by each of them on several occasions. So the problem is far from solved. I believe it's just the beginning of its exposure. It's all part of what I call breaking the matrix. That's right, the matrix of the difference between what is really going on in this country and the story being sold to the American public by politicians in the media. It's the same reason why the mix for this broadcast features the title track for George Harrison's newest CD called Brainwashed, which of course I'll review at the end of this report in the entertainment news. Before we get into the news, though, I do want to welcome those of you linking in from other sites and let you know that on democraticfundamentalism.org, we have links to full stories concerning the topics I'll be talking about. Just go to the news and review link from the front page of democraticfundamentalism.org and select the text version of this report. You'll find the news links there. A music mix that goes with the report will be located there as well. Remember, you don't have to take my word for anything, because I don't have to make this stuff up. I'll be making some changes to the site soon and referring you to another called charleswren.com, and that will occur when I announce my candidacy for national office. Looking at all the options and laws concerning running for the presidency in 2004, I'm quite serious about that, too. For that reason, especially, I want to point out that my recommendations about CNN are based on my own research concerning the accuracy and thoroughness of news reporting on a consistent basis. I highly recommend CNN, have for a long time. At the same time, I want to make it very clear that I'm not in any way affiliated with them and receive no benefit from them except the benefit of the information they provide. Now let's get into the news. Going down to Pascagoula, Mississippi, Senator Trent Lott, in his first public remarks since resigning as Senate Republican leader, said Sunday that he had fallen into a trap set by his political enemies, and he said he only has myself to blame. Lott became the focus of a raging controversy for his remarks, praising Strom Thurmond's 1948 segregationist run for the presidency. At Senator Strom Thurmond's party on December 5th, Lott had said that Mississippians were proud to have voted for Thurmond in 1948. Lott went on to say, "And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either." At first, Lott tried to deflect criticism, saying his speech was only meant to be lighthearted praise at the retiring Thurmond. He later apologized, saying, "A poor choice of words conveyed to some the impression that I embraced the discarded policies of the past. Nothing could be further from the truth." asked in an interview with the Associated Press whether he was disappointed in a lack of support from President Bush in keeping his post, Lott said, "I don't think there's any use in trying to say I'm disappointed in anybody or anything. An inappropriate remark brought this down on my own head." However, he said there were those who had been gunning for his resignation. Lott said, "There are some people in Washington who have been trying to nail me for a long time. When you're from Mississippi, and you're a conservative, and you're a Christian, there are a lot of people that don't like that. I fell into their trap, and so I have only myself to blame." Sounds to me like he just blamed Mississippi conservatives and Christians, but anyway, he wouldn't say those political enemies who they were. Lott resigned his leadership post after senators in his own party scheduled a meeting to decide if he should continue as the party's Senate leader after 6 years in the role. Amazing that he got in the first place. Nonetheless, a police bomb squad was called to Lott's home in a false alarm after a passerby left a box in his mailbox. On the box in black marker were the words, "We always knew you were a hypocrite. Thanks for setting Mississippi back another 50 years. Police found no trace of explosives. The woman who left the box, Mary Davis, grew up in Pascagoula and now teaches elementary school in Maryland. She was in town for the holidays and said even in Lott's hometown, where he has had a lot of support, there were many who felt the same way she does. There are people who agree with me, they just don't come out, Davis said. They want to be polite, but I felt like I should say something. In another story, the GOP looks to frisk to repair Lott damage. This from CNN. Members of the Senate assessed the impact of Trent Lott's fall from power as Republicans prepared to appoint a new leader to fill the power vacuum he left behind. Members of the Senate GOP conference were scheduled to hold a conference call Monday to vote on Tennessee Senator Bill Frist's leadership bid, but most of his Republican colleagues already promised to support him. One lawmaker predicted he and his colleagues will affirm how enthusiastic we are about Bill Frist's leadership. Frist's Republican colleagues said Sunday they were looking to the future. They said, "I expect that Lott would like to put this behind him and move forward, and frankly, that's what all the rest of us would like to do as well." That from Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell on Fox News Sunday. He said, "We're going to begin that process Monday when we choose Bill Frist as our new leader." President Bush had publicly chastised Lott for his comments, but the White House never called on him to step down publicly. Privately, however, sources were saying that the Bush administration would prefer Frist in the majority leader post, though officials said the White House played no active role in his decision to step down. "I think there is a commitment on the part of the White House to racial justice in this country and no ambiguity," said Richard Lugar of Indiana on CNN's Late Edition with Wolf Blitzer. "And it seemed to me very important that the president speak out as he did, and I think that played a role." But Democratic Senator Bob Graham of Florida said it was unlikely that Secretary of State Colin Powell and Florida Governor Jeb Bush, both of whom criticized Lott for his remarks, would have done so without the blessing of the White House. A number of political observers and analysts have concluded that the turning point for Lott came when Frist announced that he'd seek to challenge him for the job of Senate Majority Leader in the first place. By late last week, Democrats were signaling that the Lott dispute gave them an issue to illustrate the differences between the party's positions on race. If anyone thinks that one person stepping down from a leadership position cleanses the Republican Party of their constant exploitation of race, then I think you're naive. That from Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton of New York on Saturday. Bill Clinton had some things to say as well. Clinton calls GOP hypocritical on Lott. Again, this is from CNN. Former President Clinton says it's pretty hypocritical of Republicans to criticize incoming Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott for stating publicly what he said the GOP does on the back roads every day. Clinton went on to say, "How do you think they got a majority in the South anyway? I think what they are really upset about is that he made public their strategy." Clinton added, "They try to suppress black voting. They ran on the Confederate flag in Georgia and South Carolina. And from top to bottom, the Republicans supported it." Asked if lots should be removed, Clinton said, "That's up to them, but I think they can't do it with a straight face." The former president then said he just embarrassed them by saying in Washington what they do on the back roads every day. He accused Republicans of trying to run black voters away from the polls in states such as Arkansas, Louisiana, and Florida. Clinton also cited recent gubernatorial elections in Georgia and South Carolina won by Republicans. Meanwhile, former Clinton political advisor and Democratic strategist James Carville said he accepted Lott's apology. Carville, also a co-host of CNN's Crossfire, faxed a letter to Lott's office Wednesday in which he both accepted the senator's apology and pledged not to criticize him further for comments made recently or further in the past on the issue of race. Carville said his decision to send the letter was influenced at least by the comments of Democratic Rep. John Lewis of Georgia, a former civil rights leader who accepted Lott's apology this week. Mitch McConnell called Clinton's comments quite irritating. "Many of us do not support quotas and preferences, but our record is very good," he said, "and we think that we're going to continue to make progress, not only with African Americans, which the president's done a terrific job of reaching out to, but to Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans. I think what we also need to realize that what's important to all Americans, African Americans and others, is the economy, more jobs, better paying jobs, and we need to stick to basic conservative approaches to dealing with issues like the economy." That from Thad Cochran, the senior senator from Mississippi. In other news, holiday messages from both sides of the aisle come from President Bush and congressional Democrats on Christmas messages, calling on Americans to help others in need and to give support and prayers to U.S. soldiers who are on duty during the holiday season. In his weekly radio address, Bush stayed clear of politics and offered Americans traditional wishes of peace and happiness. He urged them to remember there are pockets of despair in the country, mentioning the old, drug addicts, and single teenage mothers, among others. "In this season of giving, I hope all Americans will look for opportunities to donate and volunteer where the need is greatest," he said. "By reaching out to a neighbor in need, we make the country a more just and generous place." In their weekly radio address, Democrats showed no reluctance to couch their greetings in a political context. "Commitment to community and public service are hallmark American values," said Senator Harry Reid of Nevada. "I take great pride in the fact that they are also hallmark values of the Democratic Party." Reid took aim at the country's economic problems and expressed traditional party themes. "We offer a vision for a brighter American future based on goals such as affordable health care for everyone, quality education, and environmental protection. We stand for a society that respects and celebrates diversity." Reid also took a jab at the Bush administration. He said, "Unfortunately, in contrast to the record budget surpluses of recent years, America now has record deficits that, if left unresolved, would have disastrous effects on our country and threaten to leave our highest priorities neglected and underfunded. So as the GOP's compassionate conservatism takes hold in our country, along with Depression-era economic conditions, the states and cities are being forced to deal with budget deficits caused by Bush economic policies, or lack thereof." All over the country, cities are cracking down on panhandling, too. Cities across the nation are cracking down on aggressive panhandling, even restricting panhandlers to designated blue box sections of the sidewalk. At the same time, hard economic times are driving up the numbers of homeless. Advocates for the homeless warn of discrimination against the needy, but from Florida to California, community leaders are passing ordinances to curb what they see as a wave of intimidating panhandlers crowding the sidewalks and jostling shoppers. "You basically couldn't walk down the street without being aggressively panhandled," said Deputy Chief Ross Robinson of Asheville, North Carolina, a small mountain city that has drawn growing numbers of outdoors lovers, from retirees to young mountain bikers, and people asking for spare change. When a reasonable person begins to wonder about their own safety, it's time to stop. It's past time to stop, Robinson said. Of course, Robinson, you know, made no comment about the safety of the panhandlers, but Asheville passed an ordinance earlier this month barring aggressive panhandling with fines of up to $500 and up to 20 days in jail for people with at least 5 prior misdemeanors. Asheville isn't alone, though. Anti-panhandling ordinances, as well as rules barring sleeping on sidewalks, have been put in place in recent months in Lakeland and Orlando, Florida, Eugene, Oregon, Santa Cruz, California, too. Proposals are being discussed in Reno, Nevada, and Cincinnati, Ohio, as well. Homeless advocates say enforcement misses the point. What we propose is that cities address the problem rather than criminalizing the people, said Maria Fossarinis, executive director of the National Law Center on Homeless and Poverty. Not all people panhandling are homeless, but by and large, people who are begging on the streets are very poor. Bans, fines, or punishment for panhandlers or the homeless are not new, but the latest actions come as states suffer their weakest economy in decades. Many cities say their financial ability to meet the need for food and shelter, up by 20% in some places, is falling, according to a survey in mid-December by the U.S. Conference of Mayors. New York City has seen a record number of homeless, with an average of 37,000 people a night in city shelters, up from an average 21,000 in 1998. And that, of course, doesn't count people who sleep outdoors. City and business leaders said they're trying to come up with plans that don't simply sweep away the problem. In Orlando, Mayor Glenda Hood just held a 3-day conference with churches, service providers, the homeless and their advocates, and law enforcement to discuss solutions. Orlando last summer passed a law banning people from sitting or laying on downtown sidewalks, with violators fined $500 and sent to jail for 60 days. Panhandling was restricted to blue boxes drawn on downtown sidewalks. City leaders said it works. Advocates for the homeless disagree. The enactment of laws targeting begging is rife with potential for discriminatory enforcement, she said. A well-dressed person asking for money won't be looked at as quickly as someone who looks homeless. A business person taking a nap on a bench won't be arrested, but a homeless person will, she said. It's a sign of an ongoing crisis, and maybe a deepening crisis, resulting from the declining economy and rising housing costs, she said. City and business leaders, however, said they can't ignore the economic damage intimidating panhandlers can have. Our downtown, like a lot of downtowns, is now a neighborhood, said Hood in Orlando. People are living there, raising their families there. They didn't feel safe because of the gathering of homeless individuals. Of course, Hood made no comment about the safety of the panhandlers. We're not going to solve homelessness, said Mayor Hood, who on Saturday was named as Florida's next Secretary of State. Unfortunately, that will always be a part of communities' life. It's not an easy issue. In our national parks, the U.S. is fixing the southern bias at the battlefields. National Park Service has embarked on an effort to change its interpretive materials at major Civil War battlefields to get rid of a southern bias and emphasize the horrors of slavery. The project seems particularly relevant following the furor over Republican Senator Trent Lott's recent remarks seeming to endorse racial segregation, which forced many Americans to revisit one of the uglier chapters of the nation's history. Nowhere is the project more striking than at Gettysburg, site of the largest battle ever fought on American soil, where plans are going ahead to build a new visitors center and a museum at a cost of $95 million that will completely change the way the conflict is presented to visitors. For the past 100 years, we've been presenting this battlefield as a high water mark of the Confederacy and focusing on the personal valor of the soldiers who fought here, that, according to Gettysburg Park Superintendent John Lasher. We want to change the perception so that Gettysburg becomes known internationally as the place of a new rebirth of freedom, he said, quoting President Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, made November 19, 1863, 5 months after the battle. We want to get away from the traditional descriptions of who shot whom, where, and into discussions of why they were shooting one another, Latscher said. When it opens in 2006, the new museum will offer visitors a narrative of the entire Civil War, putting the battle into its larger historical context. Latscher said he was inspired by the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., which sets out to tell a story rather than to display historical artifacts behind glass cases. Our current museum is absolutely abysmal, tells no story. It's a curator's museum with no rhyme or reason, Latscher said. It's also failing to preserve the 700,000 items in its collection, including 350,000 maps, documents, and photographs, many of which were rotting away or crumbling into dust until they were put into temporary storage. Around 1.8 million people visit Gettysburg every year. Latscher said a disproportionate number were men, and the park attracts very few black visitors. In 1998, he invited three prominent historians to examine the site. Their conclusion? That Gettysburg's interpretive programs had a pervasive Southern sympathy. The same was true at almost all of the 28 Civil War sites operated by the National Park Service. A report to Congress delivered in March 2000 found that only 9 did an adequate job of addressing slavery in their exhibits. Another 6, including Gettysburg, gave it a cursory mention. The rest did not mention it at all. Most parks are now trying to correct the situation. Park rangers and licensed guides at Gettysburg and other sites have already changed their presentations in line with the new policy. Now park authorities are looking at brochures, handouts, and roadside signs. According to Dwight Caithley, chief historian of the National Park Service, the South had tremendous success in promoting its Lost Cause theory. The theory rested on three propositions: that the war was fought over states' rights and not over slavery, that there was no dishonor in defeat since the Confederacy lost only because it was overwhelmed by the richer North, and that slavery was a benign institution and most slaves were content with their lot and faithful to their masters. Much of the public conversation today about the Civil War and its meaning for contemporary society is shaped by structured forgetting and wishful thinking, he said. Let's turn to entertainment news. It's entertaining and informative, too. You know, when former Beatle George Harrison passed away last year, he was working on a brand new album. He called it Brainwashed, which, of course, is why I think it's so relevant to what I was talking about in terms of political realities versus the public facade. It's a great album. Of course, it wasn't quite complete when Harrison died. That's why Jeff Lynne, a friend and former leader of the stellar 70s group Electric Light Orchestra, stepped in to complete the production, which was released November 19th. Lynne had said he was concerned that he would make the album sound a little too slick. ELO is known for lavish orchestrations and heavily produced recordings, but my hat is off to Jeff Lynne for what is a great compilation of music and styles. They're mixed in. As a big Harrison fan, I can detect where Harrison may have added some guitar solos and sweetening, but for the most part, it's one of Harrison's best. I particularly like the song Brainwashed, because of its lyrics, of course, and of course my own belief that Americans are more or less caught in a matrix of political facades and lies. Song says, brainwashed by our leaders, by our kings and queens, brainwashed in the open, and brainwashed behind the scenes. Pretty much covers it for me. It's a great album, 48 minutes and 12 cuts. I especially like the credits. Harrison quotes, "There was never a time when you or I did not exist, nor will there be any future when we shall cease to be." Another great CD out there, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. What a surprise. The Last DJ, another one of those albums by an older artist that is about as eclectic as they get, but it makes some incredible statements about where things have gone in the world and what's been lost in the transaction. The Last DJ, great rock and roll. Go get it. One final note, congratulations to the American media, they'll love me for saying this, for allowing the words elitism and classism into the American vernacular. By acknowledging what's going on, it can be corrected. All we have to do is define what it is. We'll get to that. Remember, it's not about dividing us. It's about creating a discussion that allows for resolution. With that, we'll call it a wrap. This is Charles Wren at DemocraticFundamentalism.org. Have a great new year.